Thank you. Two very wonderful pieces this morning. Thank you. Some years ago, while doing one of my many and oft-repeated bookstore browsings, I was working my way through the philosophy and religion section when I came across the title, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Understanding Buddhism. I must have been in an overly critical frame of mind at the moment. I get into that once in a while I sort of walk around taking issue with whatever I see. And I don't know why, I don't do that very often, but once in a while. Because my first thought when I saw this was, what self-respecting Buddhist scholar would want to lend his or her name to a book with a title like that? Upon further review, I experienced a bit of internal embarrassment when I looked at the author's name and realized it was someone I knew. And actually respected a great deal. His name is Gary Gach, G-A-C-H. He's one of my Bay Area friends. We occasionally get together for a little coffee and conversation whenever I'm out that way. So I stood there in the bookstore aisle and offered a silent apology to Gary for thinking about him in a disparaging way. And then I figured as an act of contrition, I bought his book. It was the least I could do at that point. Actually, it's been very helpful to me over the years when it comes to my understanding of Buddhism, which I will admit is still rather sketchy. As an introduction to what I want to share today, though, I'm going to read just a small piece from the book's opening chapter as my friend sets it forth. As long as there are people living their life as if sleepwalking, there'll always be someone or something called an awakener. That's what Buddha means in essence. Thus, it might be said that an alarm clock is a Buddha, if it wakes you up, spiritually, psychically, and physically, really awakens. Or it could be the sound of a bird, or the look of amazement on a baby's face. Stop, right now, be attentive, listen, and look. A Buddha voice, or a Buddha sight, will probably appear. Yeah, good words, Gary. Thank you. Over the course of human history, certain human beings have emerged who have played this role of an awakener. That is to say, someone who awakens in the human mind and heart and spirit new ways of seeing our world, our plate, and the place of our lives within it. Someone who awakens us to new possibilities for ourselves. I see Siddhartha, who was later called the Buddha, and Jesus, who was later called the Christ, as two such awakeners. They each in their own way, with Siddhartha preceding Jesus by some 500 years, they each in their own way brought a newness of life to their followers, who in turn passed the message on to others, until eventually two faith traditions emerged from the messages of these founders. While the actual events remain forever hidden from us, shrouded as they are in a mosaic of history and legend and myth, I think what really happened in the aftermath of the death of Jesus was a Buddhistic kind of awakening on the part of his followers. They realized their lives had been transformed in ways that would not allow them to return to their previous lives, even though they'd lost their leader. And even though, as some of the gospel accounts tell it, at first some of them simply wanted to go back to their old ways of life, back to their old patterns of living, figuring they were safer in the familiarity of their pre-awakened state. I'll pick up this point a little bit later. I think, speaking strictly for myself, now I think it was an unfortunate development. As Christianity began to emerge into a freestanding religion, that the quote-unquote true test of a quote real Christian came to lie in whether or not one could accept the idea of a bodily resurrection that had passed away, rather than seeing the resurrection as a wake-up moment for those who really got it in terms of what Jesus and the Buddha who preceded him were really talking about. I think the disciples, at least some of them, got it as to what Jesus meant when he said, "The kingdom of God is within you." The hope and the possibility of transformation lies within you. The potential, the possibility for our living in a more peaceful and just and compassionate and kind and loving world, however elusive or evasive that may seem, lies in you, lies within all of us. And that message gave those disciples a sense of empowerment, which they sought to carry forth. And so I use the terms resurrection and awakening interchangeably because I think they're both about the same thing. They're about coming into a newness of life. And very often, that resurrection or awakening comes after a time of death or diminishment. It's not always a physical death, although it can be, but also an awakening after the deaths or diminishments of the spirit that we all experience from time to time in the course of our living. One of my more memorable experiences from the General Assemblies that I have attended off and on over the years, these General Assemblies are the gathering of delegates of our Unitarian Universalist congregations around the United States. This one was in Fort Lauderdale a couple years ago, 2008, 3 years ago, listening to the now Reverend Forrest Church when he was the senior minister at the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City. At that time, summer of 2008, Forrest had been diagnosed with an inoperable form of cancer. But he still had enough good and creative energy in him to write another book. He wrote a whole bunch of books during the course of his ministry. He had enough energy to write one more, which he titled Love and Death. Reverend Church spoke from his text that year in what proved to be his final GA appearance as he passed away slightly less than 2 years later. Here's some of what he said. Death cannot steal from you the love you have given away, the strength you have shown in facing life's hardships, and the courage you proved in facing your own demons. Forrest was really talking about how we choose life, how we say yes to life, how we return to life after a time of diminishment and defeat, and how we do all of that in the face of our mortality. His final charge to his listeners at that General Assembly was, as he put it, to live a life worth dying for. And to Forrest's charge, I would add that one has to keep finding ways of reawakening in order to meet that charge. There are inevitably going to be times when we feel we've lost a part of our lives, part of ourselves. So the return to life, the reawakening of our spirit after a death in life is indeed the larger and the more universal theme of this Easter time and springtime season. This acknowledgement of death and then recalling ourselves back to life is really a recurring theme in many, if not all, of the various religions that have come and gone and those that still remain a part of the larger human story. The psychiatrist and author Robert J. Lipton is certainly correct when he points out that practically all religions contain or are built around certain images or stories of rebirth and regeneration. This is so, Lipton maintains, because, quoting him, concern with the problem of the meaning of life in the face of death is common to all religious traditions. And this is why the themes of resurrection, the renewal of life, the reawakening of life, and the ongoing presence of hope, and all of that in the face of the fragility and transience of life, these are common themes in many, if not all, of the religious and faith traditions of humanity. As I pointed out on previous Easters, for our earliest human ancestors, their lives were closely tied to the rhythms of the earth and its changing seasons. Ours are too, but probably not in as immediate a way as those earlier ancestors were, for they were the ones who gave us the earliest celebrations of the season we are now in. Since their relationship to the world of nature was, by and large, as I just said, considerably more immediate than ours is today, those early ancestors may have felt a greater sense of urgency in welcoming life back to a seemingly dead earth. I know even today, we here, certainly in this part of the world, it's been my experience anyway, we breathe a kind of exasperated sigh of relief when winter finally lets go. I know I certainly did this time around. But those who came way before us knew that if the earth did not come back to life, after being seemingly dead, they themselves would not live much longer. So when they sang or danced or chanted or otherwise celebrated in whatever ways they did, their own version of the hymn we sang earlier, "Lo, the Earth Awakes Again," they were addressing matters that had to do with their very immediate survival. With the coming of the Christian and Judaic faiths, they set the holiest of times in their yearly cycles. I don't think it was any accident that they set the holiest of times in their yearly cycles at approximately the same time as those earlier seasonal celebrations in our hemisphere. And they told their own stories or myths or legends about new life emerging and awakening in the face of death. Having touched already on Buddhism and Christianity, I'll also point out that the time of Passover, the celebration of the movement from bondage to freedom, as we remembered and told it in the wonderful Seder we had here on a Friday night, that corresponds to the celebrations of the release from the bondage of winter and the deliverance into the hope of spring. So what in the Christian community and beyond is called Easter is really a universal event that has always been observed at this time of the year under a variety of names and using a variety of stories and myths and narratives, all of them addressing this universal affirmation of a return to life after a time of seeming death. Well, I want to take this matter of awakening in a slightly different direction now. Take a look at what it means to stay awake or reawaken. As we move through those times we all encounter of loss or difficulty, when fear and uncertainty come to hold sway, times, that is, when we encounter the many deaths in life that are an inevitable part of the human experience. My colleague in the UU ministry, another colleague in addition to Reverend Church, Reverend Sarah Campbell, describes this time of year, I like her words, this in-between season when spring's warmth softens the winter earth and winter's chill snatches back the spring air. When each day is this unpredictable and an unreliable combination of what was and what will be, of the already and the not yet. I don't know about you, but I can't find better words to describe what's been going on for the past several weeks, right on down to this last 2 days when it comes to the weather we've had. Just think about the difference between yesterday and today, for example. Here we are at the end of April, on one of the very latest dates that Easter can occur, and we're still getting our taste of what Sarah calls an in-between season. I think since the calendar date for the arrival of spring, back on the 21st of March, I believe we've had temperatures from the 70s to the 30s. You know, one day I'm breaking out the shorts, and the next day it's back to the down jacket again. Well, Sarah goes on to draw an analogy for our lives about this sometimes frustrating transition time of year. Here's what she says. Transitions are times when we are neither where we were nor where we will be, when the thick skin of habit that has protected us in former times surrenders to the possibilities of growth and renewal, rendering us sensitive and vulnerable until we emerge into new ways of being. To find oneself, then, in the manner of this still uncertain season we are in, between an ending and a beginning, between a death in life and the possibility of new life, is a precarious and even at times frightful place to be. It's also a time to stay awake, a time to be open to new awakenings and new possibilities. However dubious its historicity may be, I find a very intriguing side story in the crucifixion and resurrection legends of the New Testament. I said that my earlier take on the resurrection is that what actually happened was a wake-up moment on the part of the disciples. But to return to that thread for just a moment, before that time came, so the story goes, the disciples themselves found themselves in this in-between time, between a crucifixion and a resurrection, between, in a broader sense, life and death. And in that in-between time, they did something very human. They ran off and hid, so the story goes. They figured the safest thing to do was to return to the lives they'd known before they met up with Jesus. lives as peasant farmers or fishermen or whatever else they were doing. Something very human, as just noted, is being recounted in this part of the story. For those followers of Jesus, their plans got upset once he was put to death. The direction they thought their lives were taking came to an abrupt end. Their hopes were dashed. They didn't know where to turn. They were vulnerable. They pulled back within themselves. And they initially decided to crawl back into what Reverend Campbell calls thick skins of habit. They were sensitive and vulnerable and figured their best move was to return to their old lives. Think about that for a moment. Think about how sometimes we respond to those sensitive and vulnerable times in our own lives. A relationship ends. You lose a friend or a relative unexpectedly. You lose a vision of yourself and what you thought your life was going to be. Some of the assumptions and values you've been living by no longer seem to quite fit or sustain you as well anymore. Maybe old issues you thought you'd settled come back to disturb in unexpected ways. In any situation like that, the usual human response is to run off and hide. To use another metaphor from this New Testament legend, there's something safe and comfortable about curling up in a cave and pulling a large stone over the entryway when one is in an especially painful and vulnerable place. And up to a point, this is both a natural and maybe even for a time a necessary move. But there also comes a time to wake up, a time for re-engagement. A time that the novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez alludes to when he says of one of his characters, he allowed himself to be swayed by the conviction that human beings are not born once and for all on the day their mothers gave birth to them, but that life obliges them over and over to give birth to themselves. We are given our biological lives by an act of procreation by our parents. But echoing Marquez, we have to keep waking up to that life by a series of rebirths, by choosing to return to life, especially after those times when it has been diminished or seemingly destroyed. Waking up in this matter can be risky, like coming out of a cave into daylight again. Reverend Campbell once more, transitions are times when we are neither where we were nor where we will be. When the thick skin that has protected us surrenders to the possibilities of growth and renewal, rendering us sensitive and vulnerable until we emerge into new ways of being again. The resurrection of the earth, which is slowly taking place now, is something we witness, something we can only bear witness to and celebrate, even as our earliest human ancestors did. Nothing we can do to make it happen sooner or later on our own. But these resurrections in life, as I've tried to describe them, and to which Reverend Campbell refers, require something of us that goes beyond just bearing witness. They require that we stay open to the promise that in the face of life-denying events that are visited upon us, and in the face of some of the self-defeating ways we choose to live, we can choose to come back to life again. One of the many meanings I take from the crucifixion and resurrection accounts is that sometimes certain things have to die in order for a reawakening or a rebirth to take place. Contained within this legend is the message that yes, there are certain things we can die to if we have to. Old traps, old attachments to unrealized and unrealistic expectations of ourselves, old patterns of self-destructive behavior. These are the things we have to die to in order that we can be reawakened to renewal and to life-affirming ways of being. Easter, then, is not about living forever, and resurrection is not about the final banishment of death, any more than it's about the physical resurrection of a dead body. Resurrection is about what happens when we break free of the bonds of death that death can place upon us while we are yet still alive. Resurrection is what happens after we accept the fact and finality and that death is acknowledged. And we then wake up to the new life that is ours for the time we're given to live. Easter is also about paying heed to an admonition offered by the late Norman Cousins, who said, "The tragedy of life is not death, but what we let die inside us while we live." Stay awake then. Be ready to be awakened to your Easter moments, for your own times of rebirth and renewal and resurrection. I return to my still missed friend and colleague, the Reverend Forrest Church, to close these thoughts. The man that I've been this morning, Forrest, called Easter moments times of awakening. And here's how he put it shortly before his own death. "Awakening is life, returning after a long journey and seeing the world, our loved ones, our cherished possessions, and the tasks that are ours to perform with new eyes. Think of little things. Reaching out for the touch of a loved one's hand. Shared laughter. A letter to a lost friend. An undistracted hour of silence alone, together with our thoughts until there are no thoughts, only the pulse of life itself. Imagine an afternoon spent free of worry about the things we have to do or the tasks we have avoided. We may not understand any better than before who we are or why we are here, but for this fleeting moment, the only instant we can bank on, our life becomes a sacrament of praise." I like that. Life as a sacrament of praise. And on that note, a very blessed and happy Easter to all of you. Let's sing together hymn number 270, "A Day of Light and Gladness."